Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody. This is Nancy Ryan, Ryan Rocks at Asbury Park Style. It is a lovely Thursday night out, and I can't believe it's almost October, and it's so beautiful and warm in New Jersey. But without further ado, I want to introduce my very special guest this evening, because the time goes so fast. And as you know, it's promoted worldwide, so you all know who it is, and I know you're anxiously awaiting this interview. It's Mike Appel. And I didn't know that he was a singer, songwriter, arranger, as well as a record producer. And, I mean, he does it all, you know, a manager. And he, of course, we know that he managed the early career of Bruce Springsteen, but believe me, I said this the other day to someone on one of Bruce's sites, because all my, 20 of my radio shows go out to 20 groups actually welcomed on Bruce Springsteen's sites. And I said, you know, I said, if it weren't for Mike, there would be no boss. So I have the wonderful Mike Appel online in my studio, and welcome, Mike.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and I'm happy to be here. And, yes, I mean, I certainly was instrumental in Bruce's early career, but, you know, when you have somebody like Bruce Springsteen, a one-in-a-million kind of artist, you know, you're halfway to paradise already. So, you know, the rest is somewhat, you know, easy, or a lot easier than it would be with a normally good artist. You know, Bruce was like, you know, an incredible artist. And he rose to, you know, great artistic heights. And there was a definite progression there from the first album to the third album. And, of course, his live shows progressed too. He started off a little bit more like the first album, you know, acoustically oriented. Even though there was a band there, you know, it wasn't really full-blown. And, of course, by the time he did Born to Run and went on tour with that, I mean, it was really full-blown for, you know, what you see today. See, certainly the Born to Run tour was like a precursor for, you know, the big kind of, you know, tour that he does these days.
Right.
All I can say is, yeah, so in any case, you know, that's how we started. Obviously, you know, I really wasn't a manager at the time, and Bruce wanted me to be a manager, which surprised me. I didn't think he really had an opinion one way or the other. And so all I was going to be was his producer and publisher. I was never going to be his manager. But he kept pushing for that and pushing for that. In fact, finally, you know, I just said, listen, I don't know anything about management. He said, listen, I want you to be the manager. It was as simple as that. But it took three or four months of us to going back and forth before I actually agreed to be it. And finally, we signed the contracts, you know, months and months later from the other ones. All right, so anything that you in particular want to know?
Now, I'm going to go back to the beginning because, like, I did so much research. You know, the first thing I do when I interview someone is do a background check, so to speak. I think I have a little Sherlock Holmes in me, so I read everything I could get my hands on about, you know, you and Bruce and how you met and how it happened. And what Bruce actually said is that, you know, he asked you to manage it. You said, come back when you have more material. And a year later, he came back and he said that, and I'm quoting him because I read it and it was quoted by him, that he would have signed, and I thought it was so funny, I laughed, I chuckled, he would have signed your jockey shorts if you had presented them to him. So, you know, you're very humble. You're, in addition to your lengthy, you know, how I introduced you, you're also a humble guy because you did have so much to do and you were on the same page. And for Bruce to pick you out of all the people that he could have gone to, you know, you had to really click and be on the same page as where you wanted to take him and where he wanted to go. And it was achieved. And so congratulations to you for that.
We were compatible artistically first. You know, I was a lover of lyrics, and when he walked in the door the second time, he had that totally covered in spades. And so, you know, I fell in love, and so did my partner at the time, and one other guy in the office was a writer himself. And it was unanimous that, you know, we wanted this guy signed to us. as much as he may have wanted to be signed to us to start his career. And for real, in other words, you know, you could be, Bruce was always a big fish, a small fish, a big fish in a small pond. But he wanted to be a, you know, big fish in a big pond. And he looked at us as the guys to be, you know, the conduit to that. And, of course, in the end, we were.
Right, exactly. Well, I'll tell you, I the way it works with my show is I usually ask, and this is primarily about you, Mike, too, and your career. And, you know, so I want to ask you, when I had people come into the studio when I was with Hamilton Radio, I was their first live talk radio show host, and they were number one above all the national radio stations. And I had people come to the studio, and it was a lot of fun, and I missed that really eye-to-eye contact. However, I used to ask maybe five questions, but now I only ask one question. And that question is, who influenced you the most while you were growing up, and why?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's pretty simple, and it's what always throws me off with the millennials and the Generation X's, not so much them, but the millennials for sure. The millennials have never really gone back. Bruce Springsteen always used to say, hey, Mike, I know my history. And he did know his history, and that's why the band can play, you know, 300 or 400 songs, because they are historians first, and then, you know, musicians and artists second. And they got their education by hard work, not only playing in clubs and playing concerts and playing, you know, bars. They actually went back and listened to their forebears, their musical forebears, as I did. And when you ask me what was it was very simple. The gentleman who woke me up first was Elvis Presley. I was riding home in my mother's 98 Oldsmobile, and I know right where I was. And I heard, you know, Good Rockin' Tonight, My Baby Left Me. Somebody was playing 3 or 4 of his songs on radio here in New York. And I just said, who in the hell was that? Jesus, that moved me. God almighty, Jesus, you know. And then, of course, we started to hear people like Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry. And they, you know, I hate to use a hack, what's become a hackneyed phrase, you know, but they rocked. And they rocked my soul. It seems that human beings have this kind of sounding board that runs up and down their spine and in their chest. And when they hear something that rocks them and moves them, they move with it. They're forced to do it. It is what makes them tick, okay? Music makes people tick if you know how to play it. And the early seminal rockers from Eddie Cochran to Gene Vincent and all those guys and some great soul artists, Solomon Burke and all those characters, all were super, super guys, and they just move you. And that's what doesn't happen on today's radio. And you listen to it and you wonder, what in God's name is happening? I remember seeing a Gap ad with Joe Perry from Aerosmith and Steve Tyler, lead singer from Aerosmith. And when Steven was sitting at sitting down, and he had a little snare drum in front of him, and he had a little marine band harmonica, and he had a drumstick. He started hitting the drum, boom, pop, boom, pop, boom, pop, boom, and Joe Perry started to play some, you know, rock riff. And then he started playing the harmonica. In 3 seconds, you were rocking. You were moving.
Right.
That's the essence of it. What happened in that little commercial is the essence of rock, which moves people. And that seems to be some kind of a lost art among the millennials, because they either have not gone back and paid any attention, or they're too lazy to do it, or they have... And some of them have turned out pretty good, but I don't know about them. There certainly is no great musical movement that I would be aware of, because I do pay attention, and I just don't hear anything. And it's a very, you know, you say to yourself, well, you know, who's going to be the all of us guys that are my age expected to be disposed of, you know, 30 years ago by the new generation. We figure they just blow us to smithereens and we turn over the baton to them. Exactly right. The only ones that can even fill arenas like what Bruce does is, you know, the Pink Floyds of the world and the Aerosmiths of the world and, you know, Kisses of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no new act that can, you know, really do that. You know what I mean? No new act does stadiums. I mean, it's just crazy how it all disappeared. You just say, where's the new Billy Joel? Where's the new Dylan? Where's the new, you know, Pink Floyd? Where's the new Moody Blues? Where's forget the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Moving.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's all vanished. Yeah. It's a desert
out
there.
I grew up in the 60s myself. And I could go into school there and everything. And I was at the upstage during Bruce's early career because of my brother, Billy Ryan, of course, who I was following around when I was even underage. And, you know, Billy and Bruce are still friends till this day after 40 years and play together quite frequently. They just played at the Paramount not too long ago when they did the movie about the upstage days and the upstage players. And then Bruce, of course, and Billy played. And they always play their red guitars together. And, you know, Billy could have been with Bruce, but he chose to go not do that. He's older than Bruce anyway, and I always tell this story. My brother's very – he doesn't want to hear it, I'm sure, but I tell it anyway to people that might not know it, and most people do. But, you know, a few years later, he was the lead guitarist with James Cotton Blues Band because he was more of a jazz bluesy type guy. And then he went on tour with Clarence Clemons and Red Bank Rockers. So I was there, too. That's the night I met Bruce Springsteen, actually, was at the grand opening of Clarence's club, Big Man West, in Red Bank. So I have a very rich history in the music business. Plus, I am known in the area as an artist from when I'm 18 years old as a singer, songwriter, guitar player. So, but I left New Jersey and went to San Diego when I was 28. But I met you about at least seven. I put seven just to be sure because it might have even been 8 years ago at Where Else But the Stone Pony. And, you know, I think I was asking you on and off every time I saw you. The few times I saw you, I would go, Mike, you got to come on my show. But that's the way it works with my radio. And now I just celebrated 6 years in radio.
Congratulations.
September 13th. And I started it out to really support not-for-profits in the state of New Jersey and local artists. And now people just come to me. I mean, for the past 2 years, when I went on my own 2.5 years ago, people just come to me. You know, I get emails from, like I was telling you before the show, Gary Callan emailed me. Gary, you have to come on, by the way. And then, you know, Willie Nile, when he heard he could just call me up and not have to drive to Trenton, he goes, oh, do a show. I'm going to Spain this weekend. So, and of course, I told you this too. When you have homework to do this weekend, because I'm going to send it to you and your cell phone, to your cell phone, to listen to my country rockabilly music from Asbury Park, because hello, Mike.
Well,
there's
two kinds of
country rockabilly.
Okay.
So when I sit, I'm a writer in over 100 songs. My song's been in the top two country for 7 years, consecutive years on Reverb Nation. And
there's two kinds of rockabilly that I'm aware of. One is more of a bebop kind, and one is more of the southern kind. What's yours?
Mine is like I grew up listening to, when I do a cover, which is rare, and I did one at the Supper Club with Willie Nile, and I'm very hoarse right now, I apologize for that, to everyone, it's just the Jersey weather, I don't know, it's getting to me, but I sang Blue Suede Shoes, you know, because all the people that you mentioned that you, you know, said, they got it. I mean, those are the people that I was drawn to immediately. And then I had all these great people that I listened to, including my brother Billy and Bruce Springsteen and all the upcoming artists that, because I'm, you know, pretty much, you know, I'm just a few years older than Bruce. So, and, you know, I met Clarence, and he was my dear friend until he passed away. I met him in my brother's kitchen. And he listened to my album when we were in Maui one time. We hooked up, and he finally listened to my music. He goes, he called me up the next day. Can I come and see you? I said, yes. And he goes, if you ever do an album, Nancy, I will play on it. But by the time I did my album, and I want to get back to you, by the time I did it, I wouldn't even approach him. Because he was really, in not good shape and having hip surgeries, and he was getting old by then. By the time I did my baby, it was too late for that by the time I got back to Jersey. But back to you. When I asked you the question about who influenced you while you were growing up, was there anybody, because I read about your dad and his ambitious real estate, you know, and what he did. And so was there anyone in your family that kind of, like, who influenced you to become like a singer-songwriter and an arranger? I didn't even know that about you, that you were a singer. Oh, and that you also were a producer and a songwriter for the early metal band Sir Lord Baltimore. So, like, I didn't know those things. So why don't you tell us about
that? That is true. It's my mother. My mother always, you know, influenced me as far as music is concerned, because she was a crack singer. And I mean, she
was
a great singer. Okay. That's good.
Sure.
All I can say is that my mother sung in the Brill Building. My father pointed that out one time when we were riding down Broadway. And he said, oh, you know, your mother sang. I had no idea that she sung in that building until he mentioned it that one day that he decided to say it. But my father was tone deaf, so I certainly don't get any of my musical ability, whatever it is, from my father.
Right.
It's all from my mother. And my mother is the kind of person, if you sing her a song that has an odd melody, like, let's say, What's It All About Alfie or Foggy Day in London Town, she will sing it. She doesn't need you to say, she don't have to go through it two or three times. She can get it right away, where no way can I do that. I got to study it and I got to learn it. Not her. She's like a real quick study. I mean, incredible and flawlessly on key all the time, where sometimes I round it off to the nearest decimal and it's not flawless. But she is. And she sung with the Walter Wanger Orchestra during the war years. You know, my father could listen to her on radio during the war. Oh, yeah. She sung with the Larry Clinton Orchestra. And, I mean, I remember singing with the who's that trio, that great little trio that they used to do all those Duke Ellington songs. I forget, it'll come to me. But she used to sing with them, and I used to go to, you know, to the club and see her at the club singing in front of the Larry Clinton Orchestra. I remember seeing her in restaurants out on the North Shore Long Island. My father would go there, and my mother would get up and sing with the band. You know, I mean, just incredible stuff.
Yeah,
I was always
great.
Amazed at how she could sing. And boy, anyway, that's where I get my musical abilities from. Certainly not my father. My father would say to Bruce, "Bruce, don't play the piano until I leave the house." So
right.
I mean, he was absolutely the worst. And incidentally, he wasn't a very aggressive real estate broker. He did well, but anybody could have done well out in real estate on Long Island in those years. But my father, playing golf, and any excuse to run off to the golf course, you know, that was him. Okay, your turn.
I want to ask you, too, because I want your audio to come out best it can. If you're on your cell, which I believe you are, can you just turn your volume down just a teeny bit? Because I also have a USB that's directly going into the studio. And you're a little loud, just a little bit, just a hair. I turned mine down a little bit, too. My phone was too loud because I'm using my phone as well as the USB.
Is this any better?
Is this any better? I just want you to people to really be able, and you've got a nice strong accent too. You have a good accent from Long Island, wherever it was, Long Island. But no, getting back to the singing, my mom would sing like where Judy Garland sang. My mother would sing at the Berkeley Carteret Hotel and every piano bar that my father would take her to. And my mother played constantly. There was music on in our house. So my brother Billy and I, and then all seven of us, you know, because there were seven in my family, my mother listened to everybody from Merle Haggard to Willie Nelson to when he became, she had his albums, I didn't even know she knew him, Willie Nelson, to all the Broadway plays, I can't think straight because all these albums are going through my head right now, all the big shows that they did, the musicals.
The Pajama Game.
She was very versatile in her singing abilities, but she was a soprano too, and she sang at church every Sunday of her life as long as she could, St. Mary's in Deal. And she was a soprano. That was her preference, but she could sing other things. Now, me, I don't want to get back on me. My mom, my father would allow her. She sang on WJLK radio. She never made it to until her latter years. She got into acting and doing musicals and singing in musicals and things like that. So she did.
Well, you just reminded me of something. I just finished
some of her dreams come
a musical
true as far as entertaining. Go ahead.
Well, I just finished a musical myself. I wrote it, the lyrics, the music for it, and I also wrote the script or the book, as they say, on Broadway with a friend of mine out of the Chicago
wonderful
area. And it's called Stage Door Johnny. And, you don't want to be a Stage Door Johnny in your own life. You don't want to be waiting in the wings of it. You want to be at center stage in your life. Like Springsteen said to me when we were having lunch not too long ago, he said, "Mike, where am I on Saturday night at 8 o'clock? I said, "You're at center stage somewhere in the world." He said, "That's right. That's my commitment to my audience." And that is his commitment. But anyway, this musical is something I'm working with people right now to see if we can't get it mounted and get it funded and get it off the ground. And we're starting to turn the corner on it. It's taken me 8 years to do this. So it's not something you just snap your fingers. One of the, 17 songs, all original. And I made a decision. I made a decision years ago when I started this project that I would not do the Broadway. For instance, I went to see Wicked, and Stephen Schwartz wrote all the music to Wicked.
Right.
And there's not one song in that play that's not palatable. It's palatable, it's fine, it's serviceable, and it does its job. But there's not one hit there. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
In other words, you don't go out of the theater singing anything from Wicked. And so what I decided to do is I said, let me just see if I can't write like I used to write. Let's see if we can try to write some hits and then work on the damn lyrics and the dialogue so that it meshes. But that's an extra wrench in the works, and it's much harder to do it that way. But it's much more rewarding because you have chances to actually have hits as well as, serviceable, music. So in any case, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot. It's quite a feat to do these things. And Stage Door Johnny is the name of the musical. That's the Baby Boomer special. It's something that the millennials may entertain and be entertained by, but certainly the baby boomers are going to love it because I come from that. I am that. I am a modern guy writing modern lyrics to age group that I grew up with.
Exactly. So when do you imagine that this will, you say you still, it's in the beginning stages of getting funding and getting,
it goes rather quickly, Nancy. In other words, we're going to do some what they call staged readings, and then you do a workshop or two where all the major heavyweight investors, and there are a group of them, and there are no quantity among people.
Good.
Will know Broadway and Broadway financing, and they will give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and that's it. If it's a thumbs up, you're on your way to Broadway. Well, it's a very difficult process getting to Broadway because there's only 31 theaters, 32 theaters, whatever it is. The Nederland is the Schuberts and the Jamsons. That's it. That's who owns all the theaters. Just three groups, and when you have Phantom in one, and you have, let's say, Cats in another, and you have Book of Mormon, they're not moving. They're not getting out. Those things are still sitting there. So you got to find another theater that goes black to get an opportunity. So it's not so easy.
Who would have thought? Look how long Bruce has been on Broadway. Who would have thought? Really, I would have never thought that Bruce would be on Broadway, given the type of band that he has. Like, I wouldn't think of the Stones being on Broadway. But,
well,
Bruce reinvented.
Look, it's very,
he wanted to tell
very
his story.
Simple. It's very simple. If the E Street Band tonight plays Madison Square Garden, 2,000 people show up. If Bruce goes to that same venue, it's sold out. 22,000 people are there. Okay, Bruce Springsteen is his own entity. He's always loved smaller theaters, just like the one he's in, the Walter Kerr Theater. All right.
Right.
And it's a great intimate atmosphere for an intellectual like him to speak. And also, if you haven't gone and seen him there, you will be delighted, because he doesn't just fall into the old trap of what you think he's going to say in between those songs. You think he's just going to, you know, his politics will come out, or this or that. And he fooled you. He fooled you. He fooled me. And I was delighted with it. And also the sound, the sonics of it were very special. I mean, the guitars just filled up the room. You know, just him and his acoustic guitar fill up the entire room. And it's a real treat for people like us to see a guy like him at his intellectual level, a musician and an artist, a spokesperson for his time, be able to, you know, communicate with his audience and interface with his audience in such a special way. I mean, it was an ingenious idea to put him on Broadway.
Right.
What can I say, you know? More power to them all.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but fabulous things, but it's so hard to get in there. I actually was responsible for getting someone, and I don't really want to boast about myself, but I did get someone second row center seats to go to his show. It was June 14th, and then I interviewed her as well, because she's a legally blind and legally deaf girl. She can hear enough, though, to hear music, and has loved Bruce's music since she's like 7 years old. But I can't get, you know, you have to get a lottery. It's very difficult to get tickets for that show. And, you know, I think, well, why can't I just call Billy up, you know, or show up and go, hello, tell Bruce that I'm outside, you know, and go in. But it's like, you know, if I go, I go. And if I don't, I just hear all the wonderful things about him. And I've seen him. I run into him every now and then. In fact, I ran into him. I asked him a few years ago. We got like 7 pictures, and I said to him, I said, hey, you know, Bruce, I have a radio show now. And he goes, you do? And he seemed very interested. And then I just looked, and I just thought, and this is like 3 years ago, at least 3 years ago, maybe 4. And then I just said, I really stuck my foot in my mouth. I said, oh, forget. I said, oh, you know what, Bruce, don't think about it again. Because he's going, well, where? Let me listen. I want to know. I said, no, you're way too big to come on my show. And anyway, so if you're out there listening, yeah, I want you to come on. Now, come on, Billy's been on. I've had Rock and Roll Hall of Famers come on. You know who I had on, Michael, I really loved too recently? Who's an awesome, and I think you would agree, but I was so surprised. I had Ricky Bird on, who is the, you know, lead guitarist with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, and he did an album that I would highly recommend people listen to. I'll give him a shout out. It's called Clean Getaway, because his, you know, he's 31 years clean and sober now, and it's okay for me to say that by his approval. And that album of his is awesome. And the song Clean Getaway, Little Steven played on that. It is awesome. Every song. You want to talk about dancing from the first song? The first song wasn't his, but I was dancing to that, and then the entire, every song I could hear a different influence in his life. He's a genius too. I swear, I never knew. And he's such a fabulous songwriter, singer-songwriter, and guitarist. Oh my God, it would blow you away.
You're talking about Ricky Bird? Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about Ricky Bird. Ricky Bird.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Yeah, he is.
So he's quite, and he's a great fellow too. Great guy.
He was great on my show. But he was like me. I couldn't get a word in edgewise, because that's the way I am. I couldn't believe it. I'm going, hey, Ricky, it's Nancy. Can I say something now? But anyway, get back to you. I'm so happy to have you on my show. I'm really so excited to have you on my show finally, because this is what happens in my life. I'll ask, like I wanted Johnny Pye on my show forever, right? I love Johnny Pye. He's good. Most of the people I know that I've run into many times, and he happens to be a friend of mine, and so is Willie. You know, and years later, they're on my show. You know, that's the way it happens, and we just have fun. But he was finally allowed to be on my show. Willie let him. He had no other choice when he did his punk rock pizzeria CD. So that was a few years ago now, but he's another talent. There's so much talent in this area of Asbury Park, you know, in and around Asbury Park and other places too. But it's nice to be back here. I'm back here now for 16 years. I can't believe it. But I got asked to be on the Joey Reynolds show for my CD, and then I got into radio, and I didn't do anything with my music. So I'm only doing one show a month this year. And I was asked to go and play with Jersey Butt in England. It's a great group. They played at Light of Day. singer-songwriters. But mm-hmm. I have many opportunities coming my way. I've been asked to do documentaries about, I've been in some documentaries with Danny Clinch about Bruce and all that. And I've done a movie. I just did a movie and was asked to do some more movies. And so my career is going to, I'm going to be like Willie Nelson. Oh, and that comedian, Phyllis Diller. I'm going to be like, become famous when I'm like 70, 72 or 73. Oh, and I'm hoping
never too late.
I have nothing to do with it. I hope my testimony.
Better late than never, right?
Yeah, but folks, it's never too late, and there's always room at the top. That's what I believe, really. So
you know what it is. You know, the crux of for all artists is hardly anybody can write. There's so damn few real good writers. It's not funny. And that's why, you know, that's why maybe only Bruce has come out of, you know, Asbury Park or the Jersey Shore area. There's not a million people that can write as well as him. It's as simple as that. And that mm-hmm. is the, and that is a deciding factor. And it's a deciding factor for guys like me back then, whether making a determination on whether we're going to take on a particular artist. When we heard him come back the second time and go through those songs that he played, we said, oh, boy, we got a live one now. Now let's
right.
let's do what we can to make to deliver the goods, deliver the baby. Okay, he's proven
right.
that he's got the goods. Now let's make sure that we deliver him and the goods. And that
right.
and that's so rare, you have no idea. The mediocrity that Tom Petty talked about is rampant. And Tom was nobody, you know, was no mediocre writer. He always is a magical little guy. And
yeah.
his songs are magical.
Definitely.
And they always
Definitely.
Have identity factors. He's terrific. That's why I love the Jeff Lynne album.
Right.
Him and Jeff Lynne getting together was marvelous and magical.
Right. Yeah, and I saw that.
In any case, you know, yeah, it's a song.
I
you can't
Bob
never
Dylan.
Find songwriters.
Yeah, well,
yes,
I don't
it's,
know.
That's why you got to go to Nashville today.
I'm writing a book, and I've been offered 3 record deals in my day, and every single one I turned down because I was like a troubadour, and I would just sing in the streets and sing. I sang in Convention Hall a few years in a row before a Superstorm Sandy, and that was great. And I got little 2-year-olds dancing, and you know I love that, but I never wanted to commit. I was really turned off by doing. Call it lazy, call it, my dad never wanted me to be in music. I don't think he wanted my brother Billy in music. It's a tough business and very difficult. But I, like I said, and it's true, I've been offered 3 contracts in my life, over my lifetime, and not one of them did I take advantage of. But I'm writing a book now, and I'm putting, like, in between each chapter, I'm putting, like, 10 or 12 songs.
What's
and,
the title of the book?
Well, it's called Ryan Rocks at Asbury Park Style, of course. It's called Ryan Rocks It Asbury Park
oh.
Style, of course.
Okay.
But
okay.
No, my CD is called Ryan Rocks, Ryan Rocks. So that's what people know me around here by. But anyway, I just, I love entertaining, but I never wanted to commit. I never wanted to go on. I saw my brother do it. I saw him go on tour. I saw him. How hard and plus I was a female and I was raising, you know, I was married and had, you know, children and it must have not been that important to me. I had the talent. I was offered at 18. I was offered a contract in New York City, Columbia Records. I didn't sign with them. And then I was offered another by Lupin Back Productions in California. I didn't go with them. I've been offered many contracts, 3 to be exact, and I won't mention the last one. So, but because it's, I just want to put it public. But in any case, I'm happy where I'm at, and I love radio. I got into radio the minute I was on Joey Reynolds' show, and they made me sing that song of mine, Indecision, keeps knocking at my door, which I said, oh, do I have to? Their talent buyer said, bring your guitar, you're singing that song. It should have been a hit. I mean, I should have had it 99 cents for every upload. I've had 6,000, 8,000 uploads or something. Kids put it on their, you know, iPads or whatever. But the album's great because I had John Harrington was my lead guitarist. Jeff Levine was my audio engineer. You know, Jeff was with Joe Cocker. He was phenomenal, and he played on one of my songs. Boy, I wish I wasn't so hoarse. I'd sing you a song right now. But that's all right. I'm going to send you my CD. But anyway, oh, Mike, you know, I just what I put in my promo, I put, wow, 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 is all I can say about my next special guest. Because I remember seeing you at the Pony when Tramps Like Us were there. And,
right.
You know, and I would say, Mike, you have to come on my radio show. And you'd go, oh, yeah, you're okay, well, sometime, you know. And then so 7 years later is, or yeah, since I met you, and 6 years into radio, I finally get Mike Appel on my show, which is really, really exciting, you know, for me to have someone, you know, that is as creative, talented and creative, and, you know, has, like I said, and I still do feel this way. I mean, you're very humble, but, you know, you can't take it away that, you know, if there weren't Mike, there wouldn't, you know, maybe Bruce would be, yeah, he probably would have been maybe on Broadway. But, you know, everything happens for a reason in this lifetime. And, you know, he came to you because he believed in you. And he asked you because he wanted you. So, you know, you can't take that away. So you're
you have to be
guy.
Somewhat.
You're like my brother,
you
like my
you
brother Billy. He's so humble. He stands in the middle of the stage and he wails this fabulous guitar. And he doesn't, you know, Bruce and Billy, they love each other dearly. You can see it when they look at each other and when they play. And it's like they've known each other so long and been through so much. And Billy was just asking, well, I shouldn't say no. I'm not going to tell my brother's business, but I know he's going to be doing something upcoming, too, about Bruce. But it's like you're right. There are few or far between Bruce Springsteen. There will never be another Bruce Springsteen. There will never be another, you know, Mick Jagger. There will never be so many of the wonderful, fabulous artists, Dylan, Bob Dylan, and the artists that we have lost, that have gone, you know, that have died because of the lifestyle of the drugs and alcohol. Amy Winehouse, which is, you know, one of the most current, and, you know, Jimi Hendrix, and, you know, all of them, you know, I can't even think of his name, Prince. It's like, it's really sad. Michael Jackson, it's like, there will never be these people, Janis Joplin, they are all so gifted. It's a God-given, to me, it's a God-given.
Well, there's
so,
no question that you have to be driven. You have to be driven.
And you have
you
to
know,
be driven.
And yeah, but there's two kinds of driven. There's the autistic kind of driven, and then there's just to the drive to make money and
well,
be a celebrity. And that's what you're dealing with today. And it has no, what I call, human credibility, because you're not adding much to the human mix that you might be able to do if you were like the artists that come from the classic rock era. Not that those guys didn't, you know, unwind and make idiots of themselves in many instances. But if you look at listen to their artwork, you know, at one time it was really, you know, of a high order, and it mattered
right.
to its generation, where it's not frivolous like it is today. In other words, music, you know, like Bob Lefsetz says in his splendid letters, it drove the culture, and it did drive the culture, where today it's just periphery, it's just there, it's silly, and it's, you know, it's ludicrous for people who know better, or what it can be used for, or how powerful a tool it is if you really want to
yeah.
use it, you know, for a decent purpose. But
right.
whatever,
well,
it is what it is today, and so
well, like
whatever.
You said, I think so many people, like you said, like the people that were driven to, like, make tons of money, and a lot of the, I'm sure you would maybe agree, or I believe this, that so many of the record companies would take the music and they would want to make it as commercial as possible because they want to make money. I mean, that's what they're in the business for. They're not in the business to not sell records.
The
they're,
only, yes,
you know,
that you're talking about, look, even back in the day, the Clive Davises, you know, the Herb Alperts, the Jerry Mosses,
mm-hmm.
the world, the Ahmed Erdogans, all Jerry Wexler, those guys all wanted to make money. But it wasn't the primary reason they were there. They loved
right.
the music,
loved
and they loved nothing more than shepherding some young new talent to the masses, okay? And that's the way they saw themselves, as a conduit to the masses and, you know, purveyors of art. okay? And yes,
right,
making money
right.
too, sure. But that wasn't what it, that today is a different deal. Today, forget about it. I mean, they're not a lot. You know, like a record executive friend of mine said today, Mike, they don't listen to music today. They just look at it. I said, what do you mean they look at it? He said, well, they just look at charts, local charts, wherever a band maybe has sold X amount of CDs already. And that's what
right.
they do. Oh, okay, let's get them. That's it. And they're not visionaries, you know, picking a talent out, let's say. Like
right.
like John Hammond Sr. picked Bruce Springsteen out. He picked Bob Dylan out. He picked Bessie Smith out. He picked Aretha Franklin out. He picked Stevie Ray Vaughan out. He picked Benny Goodman out. I mean, you're talking
right.
about a giant, well, he's the greatest A&R man that ever lived. But the fact is, you know, there's nobody like that remotely today. But
right.
back in our day, along with, you know, peers of John Hammond, were guys like Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss and Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler. You know what I mean? In other words, Hammond had some competition. You know what I mean? It didn't mean Hammond wasn't better than them. But the fact is, you know, he had there was a period where it was the, you know, the golden era of the music business, and I don't know how we're ever getting back to those days, because
I don't know.
You know, all the characters that remember are too old to do anything about it, mostly.
Yeah, I think we've really been very fortunate to grow up in the time frame, the time that we did, actually, to be able to,
for sure.
You know, listen, because of our parents too. I mean, because of my mom, I listened to music from the since she was born in 1923, you know, I was listening to music from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, all the way up. And it was just great. And not just singer-songwriters, but instrumentalists and Jackie Gleason's piano and Donato, of course, and Tony Bennett and all of the greats. All of the greats. I mean, I grew up listening to all the greats, Barbara Streisand. And so I had all of those people to look up to and to emulate. And that's how I was singing in grammar school. So I sang all through grammar school and through high school. And then I became a park singer and on the boardwalk and everywhere I went, and a cafe player. And then, like, when I finally did my CD, it was great because it was like my completing my musical journey of only 12 songs, and I've written over 100, but it was my accomplishment. And then it took me to Joey Reynolds in New York, and then I did lots of interviews, but I got into having my own radio show within 3 weeks. And so now I've been, you know, nominated in the category of top radio personality supporting live music. And I've had everyone in Asbury on my show who I love and support, Quincy Mumford and Matt O'Ree, and you name them. They've been, you know, all the locals, they've all been on my show. I love it. I love supporting local talent. It gives me great joy because I am such a lover of music myself. And so
that's why you're doing what you're doing. You are at
that
stage in your own life.
Exactly.
Well, you're doing what you love,
I,
and that's a very important thing to do. You're one
I
with yourself.
It.
You mentioned Jackie Gleason before. Yes, apparently you do. You mentioned Jackie Gleason before, listening to old records like this. It brings me back to a funny story. All my life, my grandmother. My grandmother always watched Jimmy Durante. And I always looked at Jimmy Durante and that little crushed fedora he wore, playing the piano, talking with that big schnoz. And I always said, how the hell did this guy ever get there and have his own show back in the day?
Right.
Because
right.
back in the day, it was even more important to look good looking and all this kind of stuff, right? Until one day I was watching television, and they were showing some old George M. Cohen newsreels, like films. And George was, of course, a great writer and a prolific writer. He was a producer. He was a singer himself. He was an arranger. Forget about this guy. I mean, the things that some of these old guys, you know, the Buster Keatons, they were multi-talented guys. So was this guy.
Right.
But there was a piano player on stage with him. And I saw it out of the corner of my eye. I said, Jesus Christ, that was Jimmy Durante. Oh, that's
what did
why
he what
got
was his
there.
Famous
he
song?
Was
what
with
was
great people
song?
Like George M. Cohen. And if George M. Cohen thought enough of putting Jimmy Durante on stage with him, that's enough for Mike Appel.
Right.
And that
what
was it.
What was, I can hear right now. I can see him at the piano. I can hear him singing it, but I don't remember the song. What was the song he always said it?
Hello, it's Mrs. Mrs. Calabash. Where are you tonight? You know, that was how he signed off.
Yeah, he sang a song too, and I forget what. I don't know. He used to do something really funny too, and say something really funny, but. I have to go because I haven't even mentioned my not-for-profits yet. So I want to thank, and I have 10 of them to go through. I want to thank you so much, Mike, for being on the show. We could have done hours and hours. But, you know, when you're ready to promote your Stage Door Johnny and you have the information, just like send it to me. And I'll do, you know, I'll do lineups, newsflash, and I'll put it all over and, you know, I'll be happy.
Thank you very much. I truly appreciate that, Nancy.
Yeah,
Nancy, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. I don't just promote someone for the show. Once they're on my show, like my friend Mike Marino, the comedian, and all these comedians I've done, some of the Food Quest, they come to me and I promote them for the rest of their careers. Every time if I see them doing something, I put their interview up so people can hear it.
Well,
and,
that's very kind of you.
Thank you so much. It's been very nice to have you on the show. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure everybody else is going to enjoy it, too. It's going worldwide. It's going on 22 probably Springsteen groups that my show has welcomed on for 2.5 years now, almost 3 years now. And, I thank you, and I have to move on with my not-for-profits.
Right. The pleasure was all mine, Nancy. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike, and have a, well, it's not Friday, but almost, so have a fabulous weekend. Bye-bye.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that was Mike. Bye, Mike. That was Mike Appel. It was an awesome interview, and I left my list, and I'm going to have to say it now by, you know, my memory. I have it right here. Thank goodness. Okay, so I have 10 of the best not-for-profits in the state of New Jersey, and I apologize for going so fast, but I must because I went over time. I don't like doing that to my studio. They are, number one, Minister Steve Brigham of 10th City of Lakewood, Gregory and Karen Nixon, Helping Hands of New Jersey, Allison Saho, City of Angels Recovery Radio. She's not with them any longer, but they still have the radio show, and it's going full-on strong. Michael Schwartz, Director of Hometown Heroes. Carlos Rodriguez, Director of the Food Bank of Monmouth and Ocean Counties. Paul A. Ressler, President and CEO of TUPAC, the Overdose Prevention Agency Corporation. Tim McClune, Founder of Holiday Express. Jersey Shore Rescue Mission on Memorial Drive in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Nick Clemens, Bullying, We're Kicking It. And Bev Cruz, Hit the Streets for the Homeless. Please get involved with some of these not-for-profits. They are definitely angels here on earth. And I want to mention my three radio sponsors who have been very good to me and who support my radio show in a way that really helps me to achieve some of my dreams, which is, number one, Smiles on Broadway, my doctor, Inna Silman, who has given me a beautiful Hollywood smile so I can do movies and continue to do movies. Number two is the Marin Wellness Center, and they're located in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. And I go and I do their core strengthening for my back, to keep my back going strong because so I can continue to play the guitar. And number three, my most recent, and who I've known for a very long time, and who is my most recent, is George C. Peck, Jr. He is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon, and he is really, his dad wrote the book, and he's got a brother, and they have up there in West Orange. And I would recommend anyone that's having any challenges or just want to be more beautiful to go and see Dr. Peck. So there I go. I'm going to sign off. This is Nancy Ryan, Ryan Moxett, Asbury Park Style, enjoying another fabulous Thursday and a wonderful show. Thank you so much for being with me. Good night now.